Hello, everybody. Today is Friday, May 7th. I am Bill Murphy, here to read the New York Times and the Hartford Courant front pages. Taking a look at the pictures, the main picture on the front page of the New York Times is a picture of a little boy named Cash Hinkey. He's 12 years old, and he's on a road, almost looks like a desert. He's just by himself running. And he's taking part in a prayer run planned by Nevada's Fort McDermitt Paiute and Shoshone, Shoshone tribe, to raise awareness about the Thacker Pass lithium mine. And with that, I'll just tell you that's the picture, and we're going to read the story. It'll be my first story today from the front page of the New York Times. Over to the Hartford Courant, the main picture is a picture of two gentlemen, one named Alexis Lust and the other named Parker Smith. They are in front of the Capitol building, the Hartford Capitol building, and they are putting up, installing a huge heart that says love. I'm not sure what it's made out of. It could be heavy cardboard. It looks like they're leaning it against some kind of a tripod, way in the front of the Courant. And I'm going to read the caption to you. It gives you most of the information, what the picture is. Alexis Lust just left. He's on the left side here, and Parker Smith, and saw one of 4 8-foot hearts Thursday outside the Capitol in Hartford. This is a tribute to essential workers who give their time and their lives to fight COVID-19, said organizer Jasna Standard of Hartford Standard's Capitol Hearts Project. It was put together with the help of Maker Space Connecticut, a complex of workshops, which is in the basement of Capitol Community College, Hartford. Also, it was partially funded from Hartford Hospital. And there's no story on that, just a nice picture of the two gentlemen installing the huge sign Love, which should obviously be able to be seen from the street, from the sidewalks, in front of the Hartford Capitol, State Capitol in Hartford. We're going to go to the first story in the New York Times. It's about companies, the picture that I described about the mine. It doesn't give a dateline here. Start with the story. Atop a long dormant volcano in northern Nevada, workers are preparing to start blasting and digging out a giant pit that will serve as the first new large lithium mine in the United States in more than a decade. A new domestic supply of an essential ingredient in electric car batteries and renewable energy. The mine, constructed on leased federal lands, could help address the near total reliance by the United States on foreign sources of lithium. But the project, known as Lithium Americas, has drawn protests from members of a Native American tribe, ranchers, and environmental groups because it is expected to use billions of gallons of precious groundwater, potentially contaminating some of it for 300 years while leaving behind a giant mound of waste. Blowing up a mountain isn't green, no matter how much marketing spin people put on it, said Max Wilbert, who has been living in a tent on the proposed mine site while two lawsuits seeking to block the project wend their way through federal courts. The fight over the Nevada mine is emblematic of a fundamental tension surfacing around the world. Electric cars and renewable energy may not be as green as they appear. Production of raw materials like lithium, cobalt, and nickel that are essential to these technologies are often ruinous to land, water, wildlife, and people. The environmental toll has often been overlooked, in part because there is a race underway among the United States, China, Europe, and other major powers, echoing past contests and wars over gold and oil. Governments are fighting for supremacy over minerals that could help countries achieve economic and technological dominance for decades to come. Developers and lawmakers see the Nevada project giving final approval in the last days of the Trump administration as part of the opportunity for the United States to become a leader in producing some of these raw materials as President Biden moves aggressively to fight climate change. In addition to Nevada, businesses have proposed lithium production sites in California, Oregon, Tennessee, Arkansas, and North Carolina. But traditional mining is one of the dirtiest businesses out there. That reality is not lost on automakers and renewable energy businesses. Our new clean energy demands could be creating greater harm, even though its intention is to do good, said Amy Bollinger, executive director for the Initiative for Responsible Mining Assurance, a group that vets mines for companies like BMW and Ford Motor. We can't allow this to happen. This friction helps explain why a content of sorts has emerged in recent months across the United States about how best to extract and produce the large amounts of lithium in ways that are much less destructive than how mining has been done for decades. Just in the first 3 months of 2021, U.S. lithium miners, like those in Nevada, raised nearly $3.5 billion from Wall Street, seven times the amount raised in the prior 36 months, according to data assembled by Bloomberg, and a hint of the frenzy underway. Some of those investors are backing alternatives, including a plan to extract lithium from briny water beneath California's largest lake, the Salton Sea, about 600 miles south of the Lithium America site. At the Salton Sea, investors plan to use specially coated beads to extract lithium salt from the hot liquid pumped up from an aquifer more than 4,000 feet below the surface. The self-contained systems will be connected to geothermal power plants generating emission-free electricity. And in the process, they hope to generate the revenue needed to restore the lake, which has been fouled by toxic runoff from area farms for decades. Businesses are also hoping to extract lithium from brine in Arkansas, Nevada, North Carolina, North Dakota, rather, and at least one more location in the United States. The United States need to quickly find new supplies of lithium as automakers ramp up manufacturing of electric vehicles. Lithium is used in electric car batteries because it is lightweight, can store lots of energy, and can be repeatedly recharged. Analysts estimate that lithium demand is going to increase tenfold before the end of this decade as Tesla, Volkswagen, General Motors, and other automakers introduce dozens of electric models. Other ingredients like cobalt are needed to keep the battery stable. We're going to go over to the Hartford Courant now, and I have some articles that are on the front page. The first one I'm going to read is about the coronavirus in Connecticut. The demand for the coronavirus vaccines has dropped sharply in Connecticut in recent weeks, signaling a shift to a new and in some ways more challenging phase of the vaccine rollout. Even as Connecticut continues to rank among the top states in the country for overall vaccination rates, the number of new vaccinations in the past week was less than half the number of new vaccinations in the first week of April. On April, Connecticut opened up vaccinations to all residents age 16 and older, triggering a rush of appointments for newly eligible residents. In the first week of April, the state reported that just over 170,000 people received their first dose. As time went on and the most eager residents received their vaccinations, demand began to drop. In the week ending Thursday, the state reported that about 67,000 people received their first dose. We always anticipated, as we get to a younger demographic, these so-called invincibles, it was going to take a lot more persuasion, said Governor Ned Lamont at a Thursday press conference. We also realized that when we got 60, 70% of even the folks over 55 vaccinated, that final 30% was going to be tougher. Dr. Ulysses Wu, an infectious disease specialist at Hartford HealthCare, noted that Connecticut's coronavirus hospitalization numbers and positivity rates are trending in the right direction. Much of the improvement can be attributed to the vaccinations that have already taken place, Wu said. But in a way, he said, encouraging numbers may decrease the urgency for those still unvaccinated to seek out the shot. Our wonderful ability to get people vaccinated is actually working, and because it's driving numbers down, then people may be less likely to get vaccinated because numbers are going down, Wu said. We're not out of the woods. There's still a lot of trees around. And a couple other notes here in this article. Connecticut reported on Thursday that COVID-19 hospitalizations have dropped again to the lowest number seen in more than 6 months. At the same time, the weekly average positivity rate ticked up slightly. The state reported that hospitalizations fell by 9 for a total of 324 people currently hospitalized with COVID-19. Connecticut also reported 711 newly identified coronavirus cases out of a total of 36,968 tests administered for a daily positivity rate of 1.9%. The weekly positivity rate, which offers a more stable view, upticked slightly to 2.1%. And while the metrics continue to improve, Connecticut is still seeing a handful of deaths each day. On Thursday, the state reported 7 additional coronavirus-linked deaths. Since the pandemic began, Connecticut has seen a total of 342,282 coronavirus cases and 8,131 coronavirus-linked deaths. Nationwide, there have been nearly 32.6 million coronavirus cases and a total of 579,977 deaths, according to the Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Resource Center. In another note here, the Connecticut Department of Public Health is partnering with historically African-American sororities and fraternities to promote COVID-19 vaccination with the goal of increasing vaccination rates in Black communities, the governor's office announced Thursday. The Public Health Department, which is led by Acting Commissioner Dr. Deidre Gifford, is partnering with 9 Greek Life organizations. The partnership will focus on organizing a panel followed by 4 town hall-style events running from mid-May to mid-June. Josie Wright, the president of the Omega chapter of the sorority Alpha Kappa Alpha, said in a statement from the governor's office that the kickoff panel will aim to, quote, share factual information and dismantle concerns surrounding the COVID vaccine within the communities we serve. Rice sorority chapter is leading the effort, according to the statement from the governor's office. Another article on the front page of the current Connecticut regulators on Thursday proposed the maximum allowed penalty of $30 million against Eversource Energy and another $2.1 million against United Illuminating for failures to prepare properly for and respond to Tropical Storm Isaias last August. The civil penalties proposed by the Public Utilities Regulatory Authority are the first since the agency was authorized by state law to consider fines after destructive storms in 2011 and 2012. PURA said the fines were in response to the utility's failure to comply with standards of acceptable performance in emergency preparation or restoration of service in an emergency. Eversource failed its customers and put Connecticut families at risk after the tropical storm. Eversource must pay for their failures, Attorney General William Tong said in a statement released by his office. This penalty is a strong first step to hold Eversource accountable for their disastrous performance. The Eversource penalty, if upheld, would require Eversource to return $28.4 million to its rate payers in the form of credits and pay a fine of $1.6 million to the state. United Illuminating faces a total civil penalty of $2.1 million for alleged violations related to the tropical storm, of which $1.8 million would be returned to ratepayers and $360,000 to the state. Utilities may ask for a hearing to appeal the fines. A final decision by PURA may be appealed to state superior court. Another story on the front page of the Current. From Hartford, the State House of Representatives overwhelmingly approved a state constitutional amendment Thursday to allow early in-person voting so that Connecticut could join more than 40 other states that already have similar provisions. Democrats pushing for the bill said that Connecticut is behind the times when compared to most other states and needs to make better provisions for voters headed to the polls. The reason for the delay, they said, is that Connecticut's voting provisions can be changed only by constitutional amendment, an often lengthy process that is not required in some other states. After a debate that lasted about 90 minutes, the House approved the amendment by a 115-26 vote with 10 members absent. All Democrats voted in favor, while 26 Republicans opposed the measure. If also approved by the state Senate, the amendment would be placed on the general election ballot for voters in November 2022 in a process that does not need the approval of the governor. The sole question that would be put to the voters is, quote, shall the Constitution of the state be amended to permit the General Assembly to provide for early voting? Proponents said it is a disservice to residents to restrict voting to 14 hours on one Tuesday in November from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. that conflict with work, childcare, or school commitments. Opponents said there are still too many unanswered questions that include the costs of paying additional workers to keep the polls open for more hours and not enough safeguards for photo identification to protect against potential fraud. House Speaker Matt Ritter of Hartford said the national controversy over the election between then-President Donald J. Trump and Democrat Joe Biden, plus the ongoing pandemic, have raised the profile of voting issues. I'm not going to go into much detail about why early voting and no excuse absentee balloting are important, Ritter said at a news conference before the debate. I think it's pretty self-explanatory after the last year in this country, and its core is just making voting easier. Another story on the front page of the current University of Hartford Board of Regents voted Thursday to transition the university's athletic program from Division I to Division III. The university will submit to the NCAA a formal request to join Division III in January 2022 and hopes to be reclassified no later than September 1st, 2025. The school said in a statement that scholarships and coaching contracts will be honored. It's a day of mixed emotions for us, without question, Board of Regents Vice Chair Kathy Beeren said in an interview. The board has been thoughtful and careful in our deliberations. I thought the discussion we had this evening was reflective of that. I think this was a clear message that was the direction the board felt we should go on. She continued, having said that, we realize it's disappointing to a lot of people. We feel like it sets the university up on a good path for long-term success. In a statement, Board of Regents Chair David Gordon called intercollegiate athletics an integral part of the University of Hartford's student experience, but said a shift to Division III will allow the university to further strengthen the academic, co-curricular, and wellness experience for all students. While we know this decision will disappoint some members of our community, we remain confident that this shift is in the best long-term interests of the institution and all its students, Gordon said. Thursday's vote came after a consulting firm's report commissioned by UHART President Gregory Woodward and published publicly April 15th recommended the school transition to Division III to reduce aid to athletes, coaches' salaries, and athletic department operating costs. The report said UHART's athletic department would save more than $9 million annually from such a move, though critics have argued the true savings would be more modest. The report's recommendation that UHART transition to Division III sparked backlash from athletes and alumni who organized rallies and signed petitions seeking to keep the school in Division I. Critics of the proposed shift to Division III have argued that Division I athletics bring attention to a school while benefiting fundraising and alumni engagement. Others have pointed to UHART's declining enrollment and resulting financial troubles as justification for a potential shift to Division III. According to figures from the university undergraduate enrollment, UHART dropped about 14% from the fall of 2015 to the fall of 2020, and total enrollment was down about 6.5% during that period. The University of Hartford owes so much to the generations of student athletes and athletic staff who have added immeasurably to our community and are a source of pride for the university, Woodward said in a statement Thursday night.